Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 276, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and would like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, Jason Heaton. Hey Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm a couple days back from my trip and slightly jet-lagged, although last night I got a proper 8 hours of sleep, so feeling pretty perky.
Can't ask for much more than that.
Yeah, nice. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Much better on the way back than on the way over. I don't know why, but I can never figure out the logic of jet lag, frankly.
You were more jet-lagged when you went out there?
Well, yeah, and part of that problem is I don't sleep on flights at all, pretty much, and it was an overnight flight, so I landed at 7 in the morning in England and then had to kind of hit the ground running, so I was up for, you know, like over 24 hours straight with no sleep, which always kind of, that's rough.
That'll fry you. Oh, yeah, sure.
But
yeah. Well, look, we've got all of that coming up in the main part of the show, including a great chat that you recorded. Should be a pretty fun episode.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you made it back, obviously. You've been back for a couple days at this point. Do you have another trip coming up, or are you home for a bit?
I am home until Geneva. So, gosh, I mean, less than
theoretically, me too.
Yeah, theoretically, right.
Yeah, we'll be almost flying home in a month. By the time this episode comes out, it'll be within a month of it being over, which is very scary.
It is very scary.
If my audio sounds a little different today, or very different, I'm recording from my in-laws' home in Pennsylvania. So I brought down the DJI mic, and I'm kind of holding it like a TikToker as I talk. And hopefully it's not too close to my mouth, but hopefully it's also not too far away. I did some test records. We'll see how it worked out. Hopefully it's at least clear. I don't know that it's going to sound amazing. But speaking of Pennsylvania, we had an incredible hangout on Sunday afternoon in New Hope at the Triumph Brewery.
Nice.
Really know. I didn't even make much of an effort to count this time, but we guessed around 30 folks showed up.
Wow.
It went for a few hours. It was awesome. We had a bunch of people show up that were there at the previous one in November. We had a handful of brand new folks. We had people who came in from a pretty good distance. We just had an absolute blast. It was great. And I wanted to make a concerted thank you to Jan for helping me set everything up and calling in. It wasn't as easy to set up this one as it was the first one, but it ended up being just as smooth once we were there and everything did it. So I appreciate the support in getting that put together.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we had a great time. Some, you know, like always, killer watches, really nice folks, lots of stuff to hang out, but great band was playing, the sort of like jazz fusion band that was doing like covers of stuff, you know, maybe not quite as funky as like a Wolfpack, but getting into that territory. It was pretty fun.
Wow.
You know, I drove down here on the weekend, and kind of the only thing that's happened since we recorded the last one, aside from your trip, which we're going to get to, is, you know, right on the Wednesday night. So the last episode will, of course, come out Thursday morning. So that Wednesday night was the Seiko, like, digital press preview for a few of the new models for 2024. And that included the brand new kind of take on the SPB-143.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now the 453. And there's three versions, 453, 451, 455. Did you get a chance to take a look at these? Because this would have come out essentially, what, hours before you left for the UK? Or maybe while you were in the air or something like that?
Well, my first peek at them has been on your story, actually, on Hodinkee, and they look great. I read through your article, and it sounds like it's largely a tweak, I guess, or refinement of the watch that you've loved, known and loved for a couple of years now.
Yeah, for sure. I think I would say definitely a refinement. Very similar in some ways, with some kind of subtle differences. It's somewhat smaller. Half a millimeter in width, you know, 0.2 millimeter in thickness, but now it's not 200 meters, it's 300. And the dial shows 3 days in text. I'm not sure necessarily why that's necessary to show on a dive watch, but
yeah.
Seiko went that route because the brand new version of this movement is 72 hours instead of 70. So we're talking like very incremental little updates.
Yeah.
And probably the biggest one is they've apparently made quite a refinement to the bracelet, which, you know, and this is according to them, what they told me.
Yeah.
So whether that's the case, we'll of course find out as we get a chance to see the watch in the next little while. Sorry, I'm moving across my bedroom here because I can hear the bed squeaking every time I touch my laptop, and I'm worried that it's in the recording. I got to talk to the staff at this recording studio. It's not great. But yeah, so the watch, I think, you know, the big things that people will stand out is they look almost identical, but now you have a little bit more of a conventional finish for like the black model has just kind of a standard black bezel. I actually don't know what the bezel insert is made out of. I believe it's still some sort of an anodized steel, but it doesn't have the same sort of brushed look. And then the dial, instead of that sort of grayish tone that the 143 had, you're now into like an actual black dial. So there's a black version, a blue version, which I think is, the blue is really calling me. And then there's like a special edition with like a charcoal dial and gold accents, which of course isn't for me, but will definitely be popular. The two-tone sort of vibe, like the gilt effect. And then they've got the date at 4:30 now. I have to say that whatever has happened in the last couple of years, maybe this is my COVID vaccine got inside my brain and changed how I feel about 4:30 dates. But they've got a 4:30 date, and I don't mind it. It's a very simple, small aperture, similar to what we saw on kind of those, the like pseudo Willards that came out a couple years ago. And it's color matched to the dial, and it's pretty subtle, you know? I think this is the sort of execution where you almost wouldn't notice the date until you needed to look for the number. Which is probably best case for a 4:30. I definitely wouldn't want, I still really don't like 4:30 dates where they're sort of set up like a standard date with a frame and maybe, you know, an embellished aperture and a white date wheel and that sort of thing. But this does it okay.
I think 4:30 dates are obviously a divisive issue with a lot of folks. And I, personally, I don't mind it. And now I've started to warm up to that position because it does allow for symmetry in the dial markings. But one thing they've done well here is, that is not often not the case, is the number is actually oriented horizontally, like as you look at it, as opposed to a lot of them, which it feels slightly lazy where it's kind of at an angle. I mean, even my Blancpain or something.
Yeah, they like tilt them towards the center line of the dial.
Yeah, and you feel like it's kind of going around. You have to kind of tilt your head. I mean, again, these are all very small issues, but it does look good. And the aperture is so small that it almost disappears until you're, I mean, who writes checks anymore? But unless you actually need the date, like then you've got it. So.
Yeah, and I think to your point, like having the date, having the actual wheel printed in a manner that keeps the number essentially aligned with all the other text on the dial, vertically, horizontally, that sort of thing. I think it does make it seem like you meant to have the date there rather than, oh, we do need a date, so let's hole punch our dial at 4:30 and just, you know, we'll use the same wheel that would be aligned at 3.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
whereas this is a 4:30 wheel. So that's a good point and a nice thing to add. So I don't know. I'm definitely going to try and get one in for loan to write about it and that sort of thing. I think if one of these is in my personal future, I'm going to do sort of the different route than I did with the 143, which is where I bought it the minute it was available in Japan. I'll probably wait and see what the special LEs are for this one. Because I really liked that like night diver spec of the 143 with the black case and the orange minute hand.
Yeah.
But there's no reason to own two of those watches in my world because I already own 7 or 8 similar watches to these.
Yeah.
So it's all very redundant. But yeah, so I'm going to keep my eye open to see what comes up. But the 451, the full blue model, I think would be an absolute winner. Just a nice sort of dressy diver. And the price, for the record, doesn't feel that crazy to me. It's just, like I said, it feels like Seiko these days.
Yeah. Do you have or have you owned a blue watch before? I can't remember.
Oh, have several. You? Yeah, yeah, lots.
Helios, perhaps? What have you had?
Yeah, I've had a couple Helios in blue. I've had Helsin Shark Diver in blue. Huh. Boy, it's hard to go back and think about that many watches.
Yeah, yeah.
I've owned quite a few blue watches over time. I mean, obviously, the Helios is... with the pastel coloring on, if we're talking about Fairwinds and Universals or Universes. But then if you go before that, I had a blue dial Tropic, which I believe Mike Pearson still has, now that I think of it.
Okay.
Mike, do you have that watch still? How about you? Any of them ever land for you?
No, but I kind of like them. I mean, there are a lot.
You've got that blue Omega Chrono right now.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, which is a fantastic blue. Yeah. And Tudor does a nice job with blue. I just find that some blues, you know, it's a touchy issue. I mean, some of them kind of come across a little too iridescent, or they do sort of a sunburst finish on them, and it never looks quite right to me. But yeah, this one looks sharp. I like it.
Yeah, I think it's a good one. It's nice to see Seiko just kind of continuing with something that was working and even in some ways really massaging the proportions. We'll see if it's somehow more comfortable. I know that I made a comment in my story that I found the 143 to be very comfortable, which isn't surprising. I wrote several stories about how I liked that watch, mm-hmm. including its comfort.
Yeah.
And a lot of people seem to disagree with that. So maybe this will help or make it worse. These slight, these very, you know, these are fractional sort of improvements or changes,
right.
To the proportions, but I'm excited to see him in person. I assume hopefully that we can maybe get a peek, in the next little while. I think they technically hit stores in like June. So lots of time to figure that out. That gives us a little bit of a run to take one diving as well. If we're talking June,
yeah, right.
Get it up to the lake or something.
Yeah.
Other than that, you want to jump into a bit of wrist check and get on with your report from the UK?
Sure. Yeah. I sort of,
what have you got on today?
I sort of came correct today. I'm wearing a Bremont again this week, like I was last week, but I switched over to my White Dial MB2.
Ooh, okay.
Particularly because, well, it's a, it's a smaller, more comfortable watch than the S2000, but one of the things I was able to do while I was at Bremont at the Wing was got to do sort of a, I guess, abbreviated version of a watchmaking course. It was just me there, and I was with one of their watchmakers, and he had me assemble an MB2, not actually the movement itself, but put the dial on the movement, fit the hands, kind of assemble the Faraday cage, or I guess if you want to be proper about it, the iron magnetic shielding components of the case, and then assemble it all with the RotoClick bezel and put it in the case, put the case back on, put the strap on. So it was kind of neat to see, pull back the curtain a little bit and do that. And I thought when I came home, I was like, okay, I'm going to put mine on, and now I know what goes into it. So that's what I'm wearing.
Very nice. Yeah. Good pick. And, I'm glad you got a chance to kind of like, break down such sort of a very Bremont watch. The MB really is kind of the core of what they kind of built that brand on for the first, several years of their existence.
Yeah.
And, I think it's a cool one for sure.
Yeah.
And for me, I didn't bring a ton of watches down here. I brought the Red Devil Breitling. And I brought my Pelagos 39. So I've got the 39 on today. What is there left to say?
Right.
I love it. It's a great watch.
Yeah. Definitely.
The Breitling's super fun. It needed to come down for the hangout in New Hope. but these days, if I'm wearing a watch, especially in a scenario where like I'm maybe not paying a lot of attention to the like watch side of my existence, as I'm down here for some vacation,
mm-hmm.
The Pelagos is a natural choice.
Yeah, definitely.
Easy to wear, keeps good time.
Yeah,
I sleep with it on. It's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, good call.
That's what I've got on. I know it's not exciting, but maybe we'll have something more exciting in the next little while.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, with wrist check out of the way, let's jump into a little report from your time in England. Obviously, we know that you went to the Wing and took apart some watches and put them back together and that kind of thing. But I'm sure there was more to it than that. Why don't you run us through the trip, kind of start to finish?
It was a pretty fantastic trip. I flew in last. I got in Wednesday morning about 7. Had a little time in Henley to kind of offload myself at a charming little hotel that I had actually stayed at years ago on my first trip to Henley. That's been bought out by new owners and kind of zhuzhed up and refreshed a bit. It's right on the river, which was quite lovely. And then it was off to the Wing. And kind of the purpose of me going over there was to get a sneak peek at what Bremont is up to for 2024. It's kind of been a bit of a buzz lately. And of course, if people have been paying attention to the industry, they'll know that Bremont has brought in a new CEO, Davide Cerato, who was most famously, I guess, with Tudor years ago. He was responsible for introducing the Black Bay, had a hand in our beloved Pelagos design, which was pretty amazing. I mean, he kind of worked wonders with that brand in terms of their relaunch, I guess, in North America specifically. Then he went on to Mont Blanc and had a brief tenure with HYT. Before Bremont brought him in. So it was kind of a chance to meet him and see what they're up to. And the changes are pretty substantial there. I mean, I think, those that are fans of Bremont, longtime fans and have followed us over the years, I mean, we recorded an episode at their London townhouse many years ago, which was a real highlight for me. I remember that was a wonderful event.
Yeah, it was.
And, we've spent time with the co-founders, Nick and Giles English. Both of them have kind of stepped back from day-to-day operational functions at the company, which was a little kind of, it took some getting used to. When I arrived there, you expect them to be front and center. I mean, greeting me at the door, and they were not on site when I went. It was kind of more about seeing what Davide is up to at the brand, and kind of he's one of these hands-on CEOs who gets very much involved with design. And so he's already put his stamp on some new watches, which will be introduced at Watches and Wonders. And I cannot really talk about them at all here on the show, other than to say people, I think, will be surprised when they see them. They're a bit of a departure for Bremont. And I'm very curious to see what kind of the general reaction will be among press and the public and retailers when those come out. But, you know, aside from that, you know, they've got some other big changes there. You know, for several years, they were really pushing the British watchmaking, kind of bringing watchmaking back to British shores thing at the wing, machining parts and engineering and building movements in-house. And they've kind of put that strategy on ice to a certain degree, and they're kind of scaling back with an eye on, I guess, more affordability and kind of platforms that will appeal to a wider audience and kind of bring in new markets. And so, you know, Davide, I think, is something of a master in that regard. He's got a track record with the other brands that I mentioned. And so it was really an opportunity to sit down and meet with him and talk through some of these things and then take a look at some new watches. And so, you know, as I said, I can't really speak much about the watches, but it was a very educational visit to go and to meet with him and get some hands-on time. And then to just tour the facility. I mean, I have wanted to see the wing, as I'm sure you have too, for years. I'm trying to remember what year they opened that. I believe it was just before the pandemic, I believe.
18 or 19.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't been able to make it out there.
And of course, COVID threw a wrench in some of those opportunities. And then, you know, finally, it was kind of a great chance to get over there and tour it. And it's a very impressive place. I mean, it is truly beautiful. I've been to a good number of the Swiss brands, manufacturers, and this rivals them. It's bright, it's beautiful, big windows. Of course, the architectural design is fantastic. It's shaped like the cross section of a Spitfire wing, and they've got a lot of kind of lovely public spaces with old cars and motorcycle, and you know, the hood from a Jag on the wall, and ejection seats, and all that you'd expect from a visit to Bremont. Mm-hmm. And then on the second day that I was there, I did get a chance to meet with Nick English in a very fun circumstance. We went flying, and you know, Nick has been promising to take me flying for many years, and it finally came to pass, and I was so pleased. I was driven over by Sarah, the lovely marketing person at Bremont. We went over to the White Waltham Airfield, which is home to the West London Aero Club. And first of all, you know, Nick, he wasn't there immediately when we got there. So we parked and went in, and this place is, I believe, one of, if not the only remaining grass airfield left in the UK. And, you know, it's like stepping back in time. There are these big corrugated old original hangars kind of around, lots of planes, old planes, you know, new and old, parked all over the place. And we went into the Aero Club building, and it is like stepping back into some old flying club of the past, with a big bar and lots of, you know, photos kind of hung crooked on the walls, with old black and white photos of planes and memorabilia and propellers hanging on the wall. And then we're sitting there, and I'm looking out the window, and I see this loud old plane taxiing across the grass and pulled up and parked. And I recognized it right away as this 1950s Broussard, which is a French plane that Nick and Giles bought many years ago, and it's taxiing across and pulled up. And so I ran out to say hello to Nick, and it was a great reunion. Hadn't seen him in years, and I helped him fuel up the plane. Then we took a little break and went inside and had a cup of coffee and chatted a bit and got caught up. And then we went flying, and it wasn't the greatest of days for flying. The cloud deck was a bit low, and it was a little sketchy. The folks at the airfield were like, "Yeah, you might not want to go up because, you know, I mean, this is all, you know, visual reference flying at best, you know, so you're on the constant lookout for other planes around. And if there's clouds, it's obviously a hazard." So we kept it low and slow and fairly abbreviated, but he didn't manage to take me over the wing, which was quite a thrill. We flew over George Harrison's house, which is quite the amazing spectacle. It's this massive, you know, almost like a castle in the woods there, which was fun. And Nick let me take the stick for a bit and do a little bit of flying on my own, which was great. And then we came back and landed and had to went back in the Aero Club and had a big plate of curry and a cup of tea. And then he took me on a little tour of of a couple of the hangars and saw some neat old aircraft that were in there. And I drove his Land Rover Defender back to the parking lot, and then we left. So it was kind of a dream morning for me. It was great to see Nick and great to go flying, and really fun to get caught up with him.
Nice. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah,
I'm going back just to the Bramont side of it. I couldn't be more jealous that you got to hang out with Nick and go up in an old plane and all that kind of stuff. All things I've wanted to do for years. Certainly as long as I've known Nick and Giles. But going back to the Bramont thing, I remain a little bit worried. Just because I feel like you and I have loved Bramont for a long time, and we might be among the cult side of it that would maybe not want things to change,
right?
Expressly.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be fair, change isn't always a bad thing, and I am interested to see what the new product looks like, and I just hope that people, myself included, to be clear, but I hope people like give it a chance, try and understand what's happening. I do hope that they don't necessarily leave some of the bona fides that like helped establish Bramont with a certain type of audience, or you and I included, Jason.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what they come out with, both for Watches and Wonders, but then in the second and third sort of release waves for the year, where things can sometimes become a little bit more specific,
right?
Like sometimes you get something kind of not random, but more like general world appealing sort of mm-hmm. product at Watches and Wonders, and then in September you get the
right
the more like niche core sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes, but I'm pumped that you got up there, and that's cool. That sounds like a very like distinctly British-y experience to go flying on a grass track and do the Land Rover thing and hang out with Nick. So and certainly the stuff you put up on Instagram looked like a blast.
Yeah, and then members of the team on the two nights that I was there took me out for some kind of the gastropub scene in that part of England, maybe all over England or the UK, is booming. And so we went to a couple of kind of elevated pub sort of dinners, which was really quite amazing. And one thing I was going to mention is I've, as we talked about in our kind of health and fitness show, I've been off alcohol since New Year's, and I was a little concerned. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, how am I going to be able to resist? I mean, an English pub, how do you not have a beer?
Yeah,
but they've really normalized NA beers over there, and I think a lot of that comes down to rules about drinking and driving, which are far more strict than we get over here in the US. But some really excellent non-alcoholic beers, even on tap there, which I was really quite pleased to see.
On tap, really?
On tap, yeah. There's a good one called Lucky Saint. I was going to look and see if it's available outside the UK, because if you happen to be in the UK, I can vouch for Lucky Saint. They've got Guinness Double Zero, another one called Free Dam, a couple others. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
While we're on the topic, because I realize it is something we totally left out of 274, where we talked about drinking and changing it.
Yeah.
And then I just, for whatever reason, we had so many topics to go over, I forgot to add the part like, it's a lot easier to not drink beer when you have other beer to drink.
Right.
The NA stuff. What do you, just we can do 2 minutes maybe. Like, what is it that you like to drink at home for the NA beer thing?
There's one called Untitled Art that does a really interesting kind of a sweeter, darker, I guess it would mimic a porter or a stout. What else is good? I'm trying to think of some brands. I've heard good things about the Heineken 00. People keep saying, you've got to try that.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Tastes like a Heineken.
Yeah.
Largely.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like I in my experience, the NA beer comes in two formats.
Mm-hmm.
Something that genuinely tastes like a beer, but sometimes it's missing something.
Yeah.
It's like you pulled one flavor out of the beer. Maybe that's the alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't really know. And then there's other ones that kind of taste like beer and soda water put together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kind of don't mind either.
Yeah.
And I would say if you like the beer flavored water,
mm-hmm.
I like Partake, the IPA. It's the green can. Mm. I don't know if you've come across that.
No.
But it doesn't hold a candle to Athletic Brewing's.
Oh, Athletic's IPA. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
It like genuinely, I would say like the thing I could say as an IPA fan, I am that guy people make fun of on the internet. I don't really like most beer, but I do like an IPA. I even like Hazy's.
Yeah.
Which I understand most people feel tastes like, cold dishwater. Very much to my liking. And the what I can say about the Athletic one, and we can move on right after this, but the Athletic Brewing IPA actually tastes like an IPA.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't taste the same as a Life in the Clouds or a Voodoo Ranger or a Bone Shaker, like some of the big flavors you might know.
Yeah.
If you like an IPA.
Yeah.
But it does do a really good job. And one of those screaming cold, I'm a big fan. I am at the point, and I said this a little while ago, and I got a few people agreed with me, and a few people were like, "You're insane," but I think I might prefer a Screaming Cold Athletic Brewing to like a Life in the Clouds from Collective Arts.
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's just they're really good, so I highly recommend them. I meant to put that in some sort of an addendum from 274, and you gave me the opening, so I jumped on it. But let's get back to the UK report.
Well, yeah, and a good segue to that is, it's a bit of a long-winded explanation about this, but on Friday, when it was time for me to head into London, my time in Henley was Wednesday, Thursday, basically, and then Friday I was going to move into London and tag on a couple of extra days to my trip. I flew home Sunday morning, and knowing that the British Watchmakers Day show was on Saturday, which I'll get to, I had a bit of a free day on Friday. That was kind of my transfer day to get from Henley back into London. And Braymont was really kind enough to facilitate a meeting between me and this guy, Alex Beskoby, who, I believe it was on a Final Notes quite a while ago, maybe a year or two ago, where we talked about the last overland trip. And definitely we'll get into that with our chat that we recorded while I was over there. But they arranged for me to meet with Alex Beskoby, who is the, I guess, current caretaker of this 1955 Land Rover Series 1 that arguably is the most famous one in the world and made the longest journey from London to Singapore back in the 50s and was the subject of a BBC show with David Attenborough, a book by one of the participants named Tim Slessor. And then Alex, with Tim's blessing and input, Tim Slessor, who's still alive and in his 80s, sort of embarked on the reverse journey to take this old vehicle, which had been refurbished after it was found on the island of St. Helena, and bring it to Singapore and do the drive back to London. And Alex, drove, this was over a 4-month trip, many, many thousands of miles, lots of breakdowns, lots of adventures along the way. And so I managed to visit the Braymont boutique, dropped off my bags, and then got myself to Alex's apartment and garage where he's storing Oxford, which is the name of this vehicle. The other one that they took was called Cambridge. And he kindly took me for a spin. We went for a short drive through London, which is no small feat in a old vehicle with no synchro mesh on the gears, to kind of go through some heavy London traffic. And at some point he said, let's go for a little drive. I'll take you down to the river. And so we pull up to this dead-end street that ended at a pedestrian walkway along the Thames, right in London. And he pulls onto the pedestrian walkway, and I'm looking around like there's people walking dogs and pushing strollers with kids and bicycles going by. He's like, with a vehicle like this, you sort of get a free pass. And we pulled up and like parked it right across, like in front of a boathouse, right at the pedestrian walkway. And of course, it drew a huge crowd. People were taking photos and asking questions. And then I had brought the microphones along and this Zoom recorder, and Alex was kind enough to offer me some of his time, and we went to the pub next door and got what he called responsible beers, which amounted to two tap-drawn Lucky Saints in nice tall pint glasses, and we sat outside and watched people fawn over this old Land Rover while we had this wonderful chat, and we'll play that in a little bit here, but yeah, it was a really, really good time. That was a real highlight. I think flying with Nick and driving in Oxford were such highlights, such kind of quintessentially British things to
That's
do.
So nice.
With some clear Braymont tie-ins and just
kind of like little TGM bucket list things too.
Totally.
Like Oxford. I don't know. That's like sitting in a famous race car for
totally
me. Like
it is.
That's really rad.
It was amazing.
That's so cool.
It was amazing. And we'll get into that. And it was a lovely chat with Alex. He's a great guy. Friday evening, Arkin watches, Ken Lamb, who a good buddy of ours.
Shout out, Ken.
Big fan. We're both big fans of his watches. He kind of co-hosted this happy hour with Worn and Wound at a pub in Soho that was incredibly well attended. And it was sort of this mingling of people that came for that along with just regular Friday night pub goers. So it was a bit of a rugby scrum kind of getting around that place. But boy, I met some fun people. I met Dan from the Zulu Time podcast, who is a lovely guy. Darren,
oh, that's awesome,
from Zulu Alpha Straps, really charming guy. And if you haven't checked out his podcast, it's really fantastic. He's done some great interviews. Darren is a really wonderful guy, and I had a good chat with him. And several TGN listeners came. I signed a couple of my books. I mean, it was a really, really fun kind of noisy, raucous time. You know, typical, probably like yours in Pennsylvania. Just these impromptu meetups are so fun.
They're the best. Yeah, it's awesome.
And it was great to catch up with those folks. And before I forget, you know, I have to give a shout out to one of our listeners, longtime listener and supporter, Simon, who, when he heard that I was coming to the UK, he kindly offered, on behalf of him and his daughter, with whom he shares a flat in Battersea in London, said, look, if you need a place to crash, you're welcome to stay in our flat. And Simon was so kind. His daughter was flying out to New York, and he spends his weekends up in Norfolk, so it was empty. And he said, you know, go ahead, stay here. So he joined on Friday night and then had to leave to take a train up to Norfolk for the weekend. But big shout out, big thanks to Simon and to his daughter for letting me stay there. And so it was fun to hang out with him as well. And then Saturday was this event that was kind of serendipitous timing, because, you know, when Bremont invited me over, I really didn't know this was going on. But once I found out, I asked if I could spend a couple of extra days. And Saturday was the British Watchmakers Alliance held a show called British Watchmakers Day. And it was the first of what I'm sure will be many shows at Lindley Hall in London. And it was like, it was kind of like Wind Up. In fact, it was kind of the same scale of Wind Up, maybe slightly smaller, but very well attended. They had a morning and an afternoon sessions, I guess you'd call it. You know, you get tickets for either or. I stayed for almost the whole day on a press pass and finally got to catch up and see some brands and see some watches and meet some people that I'd only heard about or known about or seen through social media or through, you know, websites, Hodinkee, Warren Wound, et cetera.
Yeah.
Such as, you know, Arkin was there, of course. Ken had a booth and was showing some really amazing watches. He had a special Year of the Dragon limited edition of his new Alterum, which is a pretty incredible dial. He's doing some cool straps for the watches. Got to meet Tom from Clements, who I had met up in Scotland last year, but he has a new Monroe field watch, which is really beautiful. It's got some colorful dials, which I really am a fan of. Nicholas from Fears had a booth, and he had a limited edition. Most brands actually had limited edition watches that they made specifically for this show, which was really neat to see.
Nice.
And Fears was one of them. Don from Vertex had a great booth. He had an old BSA Dispatch motorcycle at his booth, which was really cool to see. And he actually somehow managed to bring an old British Army pistol in. I'm not sure how he got that in the in the exhibit hall, but that was at his booth. And he was waving it around occasionally, and I think it made some people nervous. Christopher Ward, I think, arguably had the most well-attended booth. I actually had a hard time getting even close to the table. They were always four or five people deep. Chatted with the folks at Elliott Brown. Finally got to see and meet briefly Giles Ellis from Schofield Watches. I've been a big admirer of Schofield. They're big, chunky watches, very avant-garde, very considered design. He's just such a creative guy. I got to see him.
Yeah, the new stuff from them is quite interesting, I think.
Like
the brand new stuff from Schofield. Because I had my time with their watches years and years ago when I was with A Blog to Watch.
Yeah.
And you know, used to trade a lot of emails with Giles. And then I was on vacation recently. Maybe it was when I was in Costa Rica or whatever, and saw the email come in for the most recent stuff, which, check the show notes for everything Jason's mentioning, because I'll find it as much as is available.
Yeah.
Big shout out to Schofield and the new stuff. And working into smaller cases, I think, is quite exciting for that brand.
Yeah. And he even does an amazing job with his packaging.
It's all
really cool. William Wood was there. Studio Underdog was kind of a big hit at the show because they were doing something, I believe, in collaboration with Time and Tide, and Andrew McCutcheon was there, and they were doing these pizza watches, which aren't my cup of tea, but there was literally a line out the door, I mean, to see these things. And they were actually selling them and giving them out at the event, which was unusual.
Perfect.
And then, of course, Roger Smith. I mean, come on.
The man.
Last but not least, you know, arguably one of the greatest living watchmakers, certainly the kind of the top of the food chain over there in the UK. And he was
weirdly the nicest guy.
Yeah. Nicest guy.
Like the nicest, most generous, kindest dude.
Yeah.
So yeah. And like you know, were just getting into, they were auctioning off a Series 1. The bids were through email.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they set out, if they've announced just what the winning bid was. But I mean, this is a watch that doesn't exist. Essentially, there's 30 of them ish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roger doesn't even have one.
Yeah, and the reserve price was £297,000, and he just announced, I believe, this morning on Instagram. He said he obviously it's very private who wins and for how much, but he said it more than doubled the reserve price. So we're guessing £600,000. And then at the event, you know, I got to meet again a lot of TGN listeners, you know, just friends of ours, you know, people we both know, people we maybe have only known through social media or through Slack, et cetera. Yeah, it was a good time. And I think, you know, some of the favorite watches I saw, Elliot Brown's Beachmaster was a really cool surprise. Of course, Arkan's Alterum, spectacular. The one that kind of blew me away was Don at Vertex was showing a 36 millimeter version of his, I guess the M100. I think it's going to be called like the M36 or something. So it's the same size as the original Dirty Dozen Vertex. And, you know, look, I have the bronze version of the 40 millimeter in 36 in steel, and it comes on one of these kind of expanding old school, not bond clip, but you know, the kind like grandpa used to wear that you get your hair caught in. It came on one of these straps with screwed strap bars. I mean, it's just like, it was mind blowing. I tried it on. It's just a incredible piece. And so I'm really looking forward to that one. And he's kind of doing that in commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. So yeah, really, really amazing. So, you know, that was kind of my visit. I stayed most of the day, and then I walked back to the apartment where I was staying and managed to grab a bite to eat at the Battersea Power Station, which was kind of a highlight to kind of check that out. But then I was in bed by 8 o'clock. I mean, that was a long day. I was pretty zapped.
Attaboy.
Other than that, I mean, again, thanks again to Simon and his daughter for letting me stay there. And then also to Steve Britton, one of our TGN listeners, longtime buddy, who had promised to give me this book that Land Rover published years ago called Icon. It's a big coffee table book, but obviously shipping to the US was a bit prohibitive. So he said, if you're ever in the UK, I'll hand it off. And he actually shipped it to the wing at Braymont, and I tucked it in my suitcase and brought it home. So thanks to Steve for that. And then of course to Braymont for flying me over and spending the time with me and then organizing this wonderful interview with Alex Beskaby. He was kind enough to take some time on a busy afternoon to take me for that drive that I mentioned and sit down with me. Alex Beskaby is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. He's an author. He recently wrote a book called The Last Overland about that journey I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And kind of a trained historian. And his company is called Grammar Productions. It's an independent film production company that kind of aims to make documentaries that delve deeper into history, look at people and societies around the world. As I mentioned, The Last Overland, he drove 21,000 kilometers from Singapore to London. And this kind of retraced the steps of one of history's greatest road journeys. So it was a Channel 4 documentary series. And as I mentioned, a book, and we will throw a link in the show notes to that. So here's my interview with Alex. And just before we get into that, I'll mention that it was recorded outside along the Thames at a pub. And so you might hear some ambient noise, but I think it's passable. So let's check it out. All right, Alex Beskaby, thanks for coming on The Grey NATO on such short notice here.
Thank you, Jason, and what a setting for it.
Yeah, we are currently sitting at a pub out here on the on the Thames. We drove Oxford over from the garage here with lots of eyeballs on us, over a lot of speed bumps that we felt, and we've pulled up right on the pedestrian walkway in front of a rowing club, and here we are sitting having a pint of beer. And it's a lovely day. So
I thought I'd give you the quintessential British experience.
It truly is.
Obviously, normally we're very, very rule-abiding, but when you're driving a 1954 Series 1 that looks like that, you can kind of get away with parking it anywhere?
Yeah.
For
yeah.
now. Although we're both watching it in case we get a ticket.
Exactly, so. Right. Or get stolen. Someone's going to hotwire it.
I mean, good
it.
Luck. Good luck to them. It would take them at least 20 minutes to get started.
Yeah, right, right. Well, let's back up for our listeners here. I mean, we featured The Last Overland series is one of our, we do a final notes at the end of the show where we recommend various things for our listeners. And that was one of them a while back.
Thank you.
And you've written a book with the same title. But, you know, for maybe people that are new to the show or are unfamiliar, let's rewind a little bit. Can you give us a little background on, well, let's talk about you in a little bit, but first let's cut to the chase here. Talk about this project and how it all came about.
Happily, so the car that we're now staring at, and there's now a crowd gathering around here on the banks of River Thames. The Last Overland was my attempt to recreate history's greatest road trip, which was the first overland, the first successful overland drive from London to Singapore back in September 1955. They set off, getting to Singapore in March 1956. And it was historic because at that time, it was the two furthest poles of the British Empire. You had, you know, London over here and Singapore on the far side of the Asian continent. And it had been the what they call the unclimbed Everest of motoring. So people had set off from London and they'd driven as far as India, but no one had managed to get across Burma. Huh. And these guys were the first to manage it, thanks to the Americans who had bulldozed a road across northern Burma during World War II, which they had, you know, Vinegar Joe Stilwell, it was his idea. Huh. And it was a road that was built when the Americans were trying to keep the Chinese nationalist forces in the war.
Huh.
So American China fighting on the same side against the Japanese.
Yeah.
And the road was actually really never used for its purpose because the war ended by the time it was finished. But a few years after the war ended, these guys set off, six young lads from Oxford and Cambridge, in two Land Rovers called Oxford and Cambridge. And they took that road, which finally allowed them to connect to Thailand and get all the way down to Singapore.
Were they sponsored by Land Rover? I mean, Land Rover provided the vehicles, or did they actually buy them?
It was, you know, we think about sort of like branded content and, you know, you know, sponsored expeditions as a kind of, you know, a very modern thing, but they had exactly the same idea. These guys, they wanted to go on a, you know, historic journey, and they knocked on the door of the Rover company and said, you know, could we, in return for some PR, borrow two of your brand new vehicles, as they were then. This is mod con.
Yeah.
And the Rover company said, yeah, you know, go on then, why not? And they've been getting 70 years of PR out of it. So, you know, as PR managers listening out there, that is a dream conversion.
That's
right,
so
there.
True. Yeah, yeah. So the first trip was called First Overland, right? And there was a book written by one of these guys that did the trip, Tim Slesser. And when you cooked up the idea for Last Overland, he had some involvement in it.
His idea,
yeah,
to be fair.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. So it turned out I'd had this idea. I'd grown up, I learned to drive in a Series 1. My dad was a Series 1 fanatic. I'd read the First Overland. I went to Cambridge, you know, where these guys were. It was always kind of there in the background.
Yeah.
And I had this idea that I'd sort of fallen into documentary making, and my two great loves were history and travel.
Yeah.
So the idea of recreating history's greatest road trip was just, it was always up there as the thing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And when I bumped into this car at the 70th anniversary weekend up in Anglesey back in 2018, the owner, Adam, who restored this car from Centralina in the middle of the South Atlantic, which is a story all in itself, I said, oh, could I borrow this car and recreate this journey?
That was a bold ask.
Yeah, but it just felt like, you know, when fate comes knocking.
Yeah.
Right? And he said, yeah, but you must know that you're not the first one to have that idea. He gave me Tim's number.
Huh.
And I had no idea that Tim was still alive.
Oh,
you know, wow. And I thought, well, he must be getting on now.
Yeah.
And he was 87 when I first made contact with him.
Huh.
And I said, look, you know, could I have your blessing to do this? And he said, absolutely, when do we go? And I'm thinking, oh, crap, you know, I've just now somehow committed to taking an 87-year-old man on a journey that will almost certainly kill him.
Yeah, yeah.
That was where the Last Overland was born, really. The idea of, you know, this grand old adventurer who, even though he'd gone on to have an incredible life after this, he did this when he was 22 years old.
Amazing, yeah.
But he'd gone on to be a filmmaker with the BBC and, you know, written books and films, but this journey had made him, I think.
Yeah. For one thing, that was also a fantastic book, First Overland. I mean, if anybody out there hasn't read that, Tim Slesser's book, First Overland, is such an amazing account of their trip. And certainly you reversing that route, it was a very, the world's different. I mean, right? So you had some other challenges that didn't necessarily involve a plowed road through the Burmese jungle. There were other things to consider as well. You had to alter your route because of geopolitical issues and things like that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess the beautiful thing about London and Singapore is, you know, those two locations never move.
Yeah.
They are static.
Yeah.
The route between them, that tells you a lot about the state of the world.
Mm.
So back in the 50s, these guys, they set off through Europe, drove down through Yugoslavia, you know, that no longer exists.
Yeah, right.
They went through Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, because that was the peaceful, sort of peaceful Middle East.
Right.
You know, very, very gentle, lots of sightseeing and shopping and that sort of thing.
Water skiing in Lebanon.
Water skiing in Lebanon. Beautiful. You know, and they filmed all this, obviously, which the British public who were watching this, you know, in 56 when it came out, 57, must have been astonishing for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, so yeah, fast forward to 2019, we obviously the Middle East was not that place anymore.
Yeah.
You know, Syria was in a civil war. Iraq was flirting with one. I think Donald Trump had just picked a fight with the mullahs in Iran. You know, that was really heating up. And Afghanistan, you know, was about to tip in the way we now know. I mean, the Taliban were about to retake it.
Yeah.
And Pakistan was just a little bit kind of unstable. So we thought, look, we'll first of all reverse the journey. So we'll start in Singapore and come home. But when we get to Nepal, we'll take a detour. We'll go to a part of the world that was completely cut off in the 50s. Oh, we'll go into China, which back in 55, I mean, it was just emerging from a civil war.
Right.
So, you know, after the Second World War, the nationalists, they win the war, but they lose the peace, really. Yeah. They lose the civil war of China. Mao Zedong wins, takes over, annexes Tibet. That's happening around this time.
Yeah.
And then Central Asia was all part of, you know, under Stalin's grip. And the idea of driving through what was then the USSR, places like Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, was fanciful to Brits in the 50s. So we were so excited, and Tim was very excited, to be able to open up this whole new chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. So similar challenges, different route, different geography.
Yeah, but it just showed you that in one human lifetime, let's say 65 years between the two journeys, kind of, you know, low average life expectancy in Glasgow, I think. It shows you that in that space of time, three things happened. The British Empire vanished.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, it was still a going concern in 55.
Yeah.
Very much so in some parts of the world. You know, decolonization would take another 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
The USSR was very much a, you know, who could have known that it was going to fall apart 40 years later? You know, there was a, you know, the Cold War was just getting started.
Yeah.
But 2019 vanished.
Right.
And China, which in 55 was a basket case. I mean, you know, it had been torn up by multiple civil wars. The Brits had had a good go at completely destroying it in the 19th century. You know, but fast forward to 2019, a global superpower. And you could feel its presence everywhere from Singapore all the way through to Germany. All the way. And that's one human lifetime. So it makes you think, in 65 years' time from now, you know, how different the world will look. You know, if you try and drive, you know, between those two places.
So we've got these sort of geopolitical, logistical issues, and then, of course, the other side of this, and genuine points of interest among all of that, all the things you just talked about. But then we have the vehicular side of it. And, you know, being the owner of an old Land Rover myself, not nearly as old as this one, I'm daily confronted by the fact that modern roads are really not well suited, or vice versa. The vehicles are not as well suited for the roads these days. Okay, so here's a little side note. Whenever I plan a longer road trip in my old Land Rover, I always do a Google map and I choose the bicycle option because it doesn't put you on interstates and big highways and things like that.
Yeah.
So how did you go about choosing the route that would be suitable for this vehicle? Because presumably you don't want to be on motorways, like high-speed motorways.
No, I mean, I guess it's a really good question. You know, in some places you didn't have the choice.
Yeah.
You know, the two ends of that spectrum were Nepal, some of the worst roads I've ever driven on anywhere in the world. There wasn't a nice option in some places.
Yeah.
And even there, we decided to really push it. We went up to a village to meet some World War II veterans, some Gurkha World War II veterans who'd, you know, fought for Britain in the Second World War. And sound like a great idea, but they lived based on top of a mountain. And we took that thing up what felt like a dried out kind of glacial riverbed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it made it, but pushed it to one extreme. And then the other extreme is driving it down the German autobahns, where, you know, you've got no speed limit.
Oh, my gosh.
You're driving in that. And it honestly feels like you're stationary when some of these cars go past you.
Yeah,
you know, you're doing 60 miles an hour and this car just goes...
Yeah.
And it's quite terrifying. So, but no, I mean, the thing is, you know, it is capable, and that's the beautiful thing about a car that was designed in 1947.
Yeah.
Built in 54.
Yeah.
It can still take on almost anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So there wasn't that much consideration. I mean, you know, we just wanted to get there kind of as fast as we could.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't... The guys back in the 50s, they could take their sweet time, but we were making a TV show, you know, people have families and...
Right, right.
We need to get home. So we went as fast as we reasonably could in a car that kept breaking down everywhere.
Yeah. And how long did it take you?
4.5 months.
4.5 months. Whew, wow.
Yeah.
And speaking of breakdowns, so, you know, obviously any vehicle challenging, you know, tackling that type of a journey will have issues, I would presume, even modern vehicles, probably not as many issues, but what were some of the serious ones? I remember on watching the TV series, I think at one point an axle broke or wheel flew off and you lost all your brake fluid and oil out of the axle.
Word. I mean, I guess short answer, what happened is everything broke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everything that could have failed, failed.
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing about this thing is it's basically immortal.
Yeah.
You know, it's so simple,
yeah,
beautifully simple that you know, I say me, I'm not particularly good at this sort of thing, but our brilliant mechanic, Dr. Sill, put her back together. And so did so many mechanics. I mean, you see it now. People are taking photos of it. People are gathering around it. There were Land Rover mechanics across the world whose, you know, decade was made when this car broke down in their workshop.
Yeah.
You know, it is a piece of history.
Yeah.
And for those that know, it is like, you know, doing, I don't know, surgery on the Queen or something. Like, it's just, it is it's something you don't forget in a long time.
Yeah.
But the most catastrophic moment was in a country called Turkmenistan, which I honestly hadn't really heard of before we went through it. And we were given 5 days to get in and out of Turkmenistan. It's a very repressive place.
Yeah.
It lets in fewer tourists every year than North Korea.
Wow.
You know, it's not a particularly friendly place.
Wow.
And we were 10 minutes in, and the detachable half axle of this Series 1, which I did not know it had, who has a detachable half axle? It's ridiculous. It basically, it means that for those that are less kind of mechanically minded, the back axle is split in two deliberately. And we broke a wheel bearing going over a particularly bad pothole, and it just slipped out, driving at 60 miles an hour, took the brakes with it.
Jeez.
So the only thing that stopped the car was the back rear left-hand, you know, hub, dragging along the tarmac for a good half a mile.
Wow!
And it was pretty scary. But what was scary, I think, was the realization that if that had happened in Nepal, you know, where there were like 1,000-foot drops, we'd have been dead.
Yeah, true.
Just thank God it chose to happen in Turkmenistan. Yeah. It was just flat as a pancake.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of your entourage or your mechanics and things, did you were followed by more modern vehicles carrying spares and tools and things like this, or did you have to source things where you were?
I mean, I remember the guys in Turkmenistan, they'd never seen a Land Rover before. I mean, the guy was so baffled. He was like, why didn't you come in a BMW? I've got loads of BMW parts. He wasn't even joking. He was furious about this. And he managed to actually make a wheel bearing from scratch. Just did it.
Really?
In his, you know, tooled it from scratch, which was wonderful. But no, we did have two. We had a 2001 Defender 90.
Yeah.
And we had a 2015 Defender 110.
Okay, yeah.
And you know what? Given what people say about Land Rovers, they were incredibly reliable.
Huh.
In fact, the clutch fell off the 90 when we got to when we got just outside Calais.
Wow.
So right at the end, the clutch went.
Yeah.
And the other one, the 2015 110, was flawless.
Huh.
Not a single problem with it for, you know, 21,000 kilometers.
Incredible. Wow.
So, yeah, we had a very small crew. You know, just there were eight of us all together.
On the human side of things, there was an interesting development, which, you know, anybody who watches this show, you discover it early on, and it's obviously in the book, I'm sure, which I haven't read yet. But Tim ultimately could not make the trip because of for one reason or another, right? Tell us about that and the sort of the silver lining to that.
Yeah, I mean, in quite dramatic style, of anyone who's watched episode one or read my book, we got the whole caravan to Singapore, and you know, we are literally on the start line.
Yeah.
It is flag off day, and I went to wake Tim up in his hotel room in Singapore. And he collapsed in the night.
Oh, my God.
And we ended up taking him to intensive care in Singapore. And, you know, so whatever sort of genie had been driving him, you know, he knew he was pushing it.
Yeah.
But he got a severe lung infection on the plane over, we figured out later. And it just KO'd him. And thankfully, he recovered.
Yeah.
But he was in hospital. And I had to basically stand on the stage in front of, like, 1,000 people. And there were 98 Land Rovers from all across Singapore. And like the Singaporean government had closed the road, police escort. And I basically stand on the stage and go, I'm really sorry, but the star of the show isn't here. But we had spoken to Tim's grandson, a lovely guy called Nat, who we said, look, you know, the sponsors and everybody, including Tim, were being realistic, saying, look, if he wants to bow out at any time, we'd really like it if somebody from the family you know, could carry the baton. So I spoke to Nat, and this is, you know, Nat, I didn't know him from Adam. And you know,
was he just there? He was just there to see you off.
He brought his grandpa out.
Yeah,
and he'd been ready to sort of step in at any moment.
Yeah.
But none of us really expected it to happen on day one. Yeah, it was mad, and you can see in the footage that Nat is not ready.
Yeah,
and this is a guy like he'd never read his grandpa's book. He's not a big traveller.
Yeah,
like, I think he'd driven from London to Newcastle.
Yeah,
that was kind of it. You know, didn't like Land Rovers.
Yeah,
didn't, you know, he just said, "I'll do it for my grandpa." And then he got dragged into this kind of, you know, 4-month odyssey.
Yeah.
And it turned out, for anyone who watches the show or the book, that what an absolute gem of a human being he is.
Yeah. It kind of turned out to be this, one of those unscripted moments that you couldn't have even cooked up as, you know, I mean, Tim's grandson steps in at the last minute and
turns out to be a cracking
bloke. These golden moments. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it was truly incredible. Yeah. So, you know, your intention at the beginning of this was that you're maybe, and this is a good chance to kind of segue into your own background and what you do. Yeah. And why you considered, you know, doing a film. I mean, that's kind of your thing, right? You're a filmmaker, a documentarian. I know you're a historian as well. And tell us a little about your background, I guess. You had some experience in Burma as well, right?
Yeah, so it all goes back to history. Always my favorite subject. Studied history at uni. Went to Cambridge where Tim and some of the boys were.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd ended up studying modern Burmese history. So I went there I got the scholarships going out to Thailand and Myanmar, as it is now.
Yeah.
And I just completely became obsessed with this place. And anyone who's been, I think maybe will understand. It's incredible. And there is an amazing connection there that, you know, was part of the British Empire. But many people forget that. But it had a profound impact on that country that can still be felt today. And that was kind of the subject of my university work. But I then, as the country started to open up just about that time, I moved out there, made a home there, and I started making documentaries, sort of exploring the post-colonial history of Myanmar through different ways. And I made films like World War II, I made films about the royal family, and then I started moving into travel. I made the first travel documentary crossing the whole of Myanmar back in 2018. This is before it all really fell apart.
Yeah.
So I was making, you know, I'd sort of making a career as a travel filmmaker and a journalist of sorts. And I'd stumbled on the story of the first overland again because I was researching the Burma Road, this American road that had been built. And I realized that one of the last cars to ever drive it was this one. And it just, this can knock it on the head. So I thought that I could just recreate, you know, the Burma bit.
Yeah.
The Burma Road had disappeared into the jungle and what was there. But when I said that to Adam, he said, no, it's the whole thing or nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's a series of escalating dares.
Yeah.
I think is the best way to describe The Last Overland.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it just ticked so many boxes. It allowed me to really sort of, you know, strengthen that bond with my dad because he was a massive Land Rover fan.
Yeah.
It allowed me to make a film about history, which is what my first passion, and it allowed me to go on a great adventure.
Yeah.
And very practically allowed me to drive home because I wanted to sort of relocate back to the UK. So, you know, you could fly, but
yeah,
why not drive?
I mean, to me, I think to myself, like, all the elements that came together for this story, the human element, history, your own connection with Burma/Myanmar, the connection with your father, Tim's story and Nat, and I mean, I hate to say it, but you kind of peaked early. I mean, this is like how do you possibly, this is like the grandest adventure I think almost anybody could conceive of. And I don't want you to give away any secrets if you got something else cooking up here. Are you going to the moon or something? But like,
you know what? It's so interesting because Tim said exactly that to me about himself.
Oh, sure.
He said that by the time he was 22, he had gone to war. So he'd fought in Malaya.
Oh.
What was, you know, Malaysia. He'd fought in the Malayan emergency when he was 19. So before he did this, he'd then gone to university. He'd made history.
Yeah.
Doing this road trip. He'd written a best-selling book.
Yeah.
He'd made one of the first travel shows on British television. And then he got a job at the BBC. And, you know, his dream job. And this is all before, by 22.
Yeah. Jeez.
And he said, you know, a little bit after that, everything's a bit of an anticlimax. You know, with, and he was working with David Attenborough back then. Yeah, a young David Attenborough, amazing connection there. But so I hope not. I mean, I guess I hope there are plans, but I think I do reflect on it now. And you don't realize it at the time just how momentous that is. And I often, when I do a book signing or something and people go, oh, could you write something in there? Always write the same thing. And it's not because I'm being lazy. It's enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
It's so cliche.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was so amazing. And I was so stressed through most of it.
Yeah.
And I was so distracted by dealing with sponsors, dealing with crew, what was coming next, what had just happened. You know, you don't get to, you don't enjoy it when you're in it.
Right. Yeah, and I think I say peak early, but it also means that it can open some doors. And
certainly
there's also this, you know, this whole mindset of, you know, seize the day. And like, you don't know. I mean, look, you knock on whatever this table's made out of. It's you don't know you'll be around another 5 years. Like you do things as they come, you know, grab it and run with it. So it's
you absolutely have to. I do feel like that. I think as I got slightly older, I'm realizing that I think I spent the last sort of 20 years of my life living like that, and then you start to get quite exhausted.
Yeah.
So I am sort of settling down, getting married, doing those sort of things. I have a house for a first time, for the first time in my life.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of slowing down going on, but in a way that I feel like, look, if that was it, then, you know, I'm very blessed.
Right.
But we are planning something even bigger.
Oh my gosh.
So the dream is, if you know, most of your audience are American, I imagine, but there's only one road that's longer than London, Singapore.
Is it Alaska to Tierra del Fuego?
It is absolutely the Pan American Highway.
Sure. Yeah.
And I have in my locker the first car that ever drove the whole length of that road. A 1971 Range Rover.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So it's sitting in a lovely museum in Surrey, ready to go. We're just trying to raise the money to do that and get the TV deal tied up. But I'm hoping next year we'll be setting off on that. John Blashford Snell.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, still around.
Amazing.
Still, he just came back from a horse riding expedition in Mongolia.
Wow.
I think he's pushing 90.
Yeah. He's not joining you, is he?
Who knows?
Okay,
I'll leave it up to John, but no, he's definitely, yeah, definitely giving me his blessing. I mean, John is a living legend,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that was just the beginning of his, you know, many, many other adventures, but
yeah. And talk about human stories along the way and history and geopolitical concerns and things that has equal amount of stories.
Well, I've got obsessed with the story of the Pan American Highway because the Pan American Highway is an idea that's about 150 years old.
Mm.
And if you follow the story of the Pan American Highway, it is the story of the Americas.
Mm.
And it is an incredible story
of
inter-American sort of brotherhood and animosity and the way that the two continents of North and South America have sort of grown closer and further apart.
Yeah.
And I think, again, like that road between, you know, London and Singapore, the road between Alaska and Tierra del Fuego, depending on where you, which point in time you drop in, it tells you so much about what's going on in the Americas.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, being able to compare the early 70s to the early 2020s is, as a historian, is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so, that's my dream at the moment. Any American listeners out there who want to fund that journey, get in touch.
That's amazing. That's an amazing thing. And that would be definitely a more comfortable ride.
Slightly.
A Range Rover over a Series
Slightly,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about it? You had a little go in Oxford on the way here?
Yeah, it was very civilized and it's in very good shape. Yeah, it's, you know, the back door flew open at one point going over a speed bump. But
Shh, don't tell anyone that. It shut itself, which is the beauty of it.
Exactly. That's true. You just slam on the brakes and the door
slams
shut.
Yeah, the door shut itself. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
She has a wicked personality.
Yeah.
I think is the way to put it.
It was funny when I met you, you know, you're in this end of this very labyrinthine sort of road in London and you backed it out of this very narrow garage space and it was such a pleasure to see that pop out. It's and of course now everybody's stopping to take photos. We've got it in front of the rowing club. I'm going to hear them they're on the rowing machines, the ergs over there doing their training
getting ready for the Oxford and Cambridge boat race.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we couldn't have planned it better.
We
could. So fitting. Well, I certainly can't. We can't close out this chat without a nod to our friends at Bremont Watch Company. I was just visiting them up in Henley for the past couple of days, and you're wearing an Alt 1C, and I'm wearing my Supermarine, and they graciously arranged this on very short notice. And so I appreciate your time. And I also want to shout out a thanks to Bremont. And
well, they were one of the sponsors of The Last Overland.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've worked with them ever since. If you're going to take on a mad adventure that involves a Land Rover, they are the perfect brand.
I think you're right.
If you've met the English brothers, yeah. You know, you'll understand why.
Yes. Well, our beers are almost gone here, and it's probably time, or we're probably overstaying our welcome with a vehicle parked on a pedestrian walkway. So with that, I think we'll close out. Alex, appreciate your time, and thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Jason.
All right. Well, that was a fascinating and super fun chat with Alex Beskowy. Thanks so much to Alex for making that possible and finding the time with Jason, and Jason for taking the gear over there and being available for a pub recording. Kind of my favorite type of audio. Feels like you're right in the space, which is super fun. So that's fascinating. And I mean, look, you just listened to the conversation, but if you haven't watched The Last Overland, I haven't read the book, to be fair. But if you haven't watched the special from 2022, do check it out. Absolutely worth your time. Really, really fantastic piece of documentary that falls right in the TGN zone as well. Talk about something that not only would I have loved to have been in some way a part of, but also something I would have loved to have covered in some way. Just a very, very cool, well-told story.
Yeah, it was great.
All right. How about a little final notes? We'll get this one wrapped up while I'm still on vacation.
Yeah, right. My final note is a podcast that I downloaded and listened to on my flight over to England last week. And it's a podcast that by a guy named Peter Attia that was mentioned actually in Slack in response to our health and fitness episode. Peter Attia is a doctor who has a particular focus on all things kind of health and fitness. And he sat down with the founder of GORUCK, Jason McCarthy, who's a former U.S. Green Beret, Special Forces, who, you know, founded this well-known company now that not only makes backpacks now, but footwear and clothing, et cetera, and kicked off arguably kind of a movement around rucking, you know, putting weight in a backpack and just moving around as a form of exercise and challenge. And, you know, a lot of podcast interviews, and, you know, we do our share of them, you know, you get people who, you know, are good at it, aren't good at it, maybe aren't the best conversationalists. I found both these guys just utterly captivating in not only what they were talking about, but just the back and forth and the ease with which they were chatting. And this was, I believe it was could have been a 2.5 hour podcast interview, which is quite long. But McCarthy's an incredibly well-spoken guy. His background, they really covered the specifics of his decision to go into the military, his time in the Green Berets, what it took to found GORUCK,
okay,
and kind of the basics of rucking. And what I really appreciated about it was Attia asked questions that a lot of podcast interviews, they make certain assumptions about what the listener may or may not already know, and then kind of skip over some of the basics and the nitty gritty. And I really appreciated that he asked very specific questions, and McCarthy was more than happy to answer them in long form replies in a very articulate way. So definitely worth listening to. I think I'm a big fan of GORUCK. Obviously, you know, rucking is a big part of my life these days as I'm training for the Fan Dance. And I really do plan on listening to more of these Peter Attia podcasts because I think he's great. So check it out.
I think for a lot of people, like Peter Attia hit my radar back because of Tim Ferriss. Like when the first idea of like this whole optimizing body hacking wave kind of crushed, it was like really clear that he was the sort of front runner from a medical perspective.
Yeah.
And I've met Peter twice. He's a huge watch nerd. He was wearing a Bubba Watson Richard Mille.
Oh my gosh.
When he showed up at the Hodinkee office one day.
Wow.
Really, really friendly, super intelligent guy. And I've definitely heard him on a lot of podcasts, and I've listened to at least one episode of his.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, look, if you're already into especially longevity, which is his core focus, I would say these days, less so maybe the body hacking and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're already into that, you already know Peter Attia. But like, if you're just curious, give this guy a chance. His books are incredible. I think his perspective is all very medically driven. Mm-hmm. And I think he's just kind of a fascinating presence in the space. And to see him going into the GORUCK thing makes a lot of sense to me. The fitness side of it, the concept of a workout or an exercise that really relies on like all around, like generalized body strength and conditioning.
Yeah,
I think is really good. So I'm glad that was a good one, and definitely have since added it to my listen list for Pocket Cast.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. All right, how about you? You got something really fun. You sent me a picture of this. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. So this arrived about a half hour before we started recording this. So I've only just had it a few minutes, and I wanted to have it on a final note at some point. I had a different final note in the list for today, and then I changed it because the mailman showed up just moments ago. And where to start with this silly story? So the first one is I came across an ad on my Instagram for a surplus shop called Americana Pipe Dream. And the ads are chaotic. They're a little vulgar. They're really fun. Huh. I like them. Yeah. I like the tone. It's a bunch of very seemingly very young guys running a surplus company that has sort of a sketchy website is how they're I'm not sure they describe it that way, but I've seen it described that way in comments. It doesn't necessarily feel like a hyper modern website, but I saw them and it was a really funny Instagram video they had showing off some jackets that they'd bought too many of and were selling for like $30. I believe these were American Infantry issued jackets.
Yeah.
Pretty common sort of stuff. And I got curious and then I forgot about it. That's how Instagram ads work.
Yeah.
I scrolled along to the next reel and forgot. And then eventually I got served another ad for them and another one. And so I was like, fine, I'll check this out. I go to their website. It is a little chaotic. I really like it. And I'm searching around just like you can pick based on the country that the gear comes from, or you can just kind of look at all of it.
Yeah.
I was kind of looking at all of it, and I have to admit, like, I'm obviously known to the point of a meme, my like green jacket from the Gap.
Yeah.
That I've worn in lots of stuff. And I like some military sort of silhouettes and cuts and colors. But I do personally, and I think I've talked about this on TGM before, like I do have some trouble with camo because it can feel pretty serious to wear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I like every now and then, you know, I really like the lizard camo strap from Kill Hubris.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's a French, I think it's a French Foreign Legion camo, if I remember correctly. My apologies if I got that wrong. But it's a fun pattern. It looks cool. It's a little bit more lighthearted than the digital stuff, the stuff that feels a little bit more like directly tied to military.
Yeah.
Anyways, this is a long way of saying I bought a jacket from Americana Pipe Dream. It is a Belgian M90 jigsaw jacket. I've always liked the jigsaw camo. In the photos on American Pipe Dream, it definitely looked like the green tone was more blue. So it looked blue, kind of gold drab, maroon, and then black.
Yeah.
And in person, it's close to that, but the blue is much more green. So it's much more of a conventional camo than I was kind of expecting in terms of a color balance.
Yeah.
But the jacket was $68 Canadian, which is like $45. And I bought a medium, which they said would fit, and I didn't believe them, and it fits. So kudos to them. It's probably like a 41 medium. And I just really like it. It's wild enough that it doesn't feel like I've gone, like I'm trying to say that I was in the military.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, you being a Belgian thing, obviously I like Canada's history, in the armed forces world and World War II in Belgium. So that kind of connects.
Yeah.
And then I just like that the colors are a little bit more lighthearted, a little bit more interesting than two greens, a black and a darker color, like, you know, in a contrast of some sort.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the issued Belgian jigsaw field jacket from Americana Pipe Dream. But mostly I would say this is less about this specific jacket and more just a chance to try Americana Pipe Dream. They have a ton of stuff on their website. They have a really funny Instagram. Maybe don't watch it with your kids, depending on your policy on bad language, but that's all fine. And yeah, Americana Pipe Dream, the entire experience was exactly what you'd want. It was simple, straightforward. I paid quickly, it shipped quickly, it showed up exactly when they said it would, and I really like the jacket. So if you see me wearing a truly kind of ridiculous camo jacket at like Watches and Wonders, I don't know if I can work this with a tie. We're gonna find out though.
Yeah.
That's where I got it, and I have to agree with the first commenter on the page who said that truly the drippiest European camo in existence. and I can only agree. I'm really a fan. I would be even more a fan if it was as blue as the one they photographed in this, but maybe this one will fade to that color. I don't know. I'll wear it and enjoy it. And maybe it'll be more of the cottage jacket, or maybe I'll find a way to make it more of like a more common piece of the uniform.
Yeah, it looks amazing. And the picture you sent of you wearing it definitely is a better photo than, I mean, looking at the link you sent me earlier, I was like, what are they trying to camouflage themselves among?
Yeah,
I
mean, what would you camo from? That's what my 7-year-old was like, there's no, that's not real camo.
Yeah.
And I said, this is a color still worn, I believe. Like it's a pattern in coloring still worn by several armies, including the armed forces for Belgium. So my girls don't believe that it's a real color or a real camo, but I like that it has that sort of a funness where that makes it a little bit more lighthearted, maybe a little bit more applicable to like street fashion,
yeah,
or something like that, yeah, than a more hardcore or the more, you know, like I think the look, especially with that green jacket I have from the Gap, is like it's that sort of like Vietnam look,
yeah,
which is cool. I like it a lot,
right?
But I also have to be really careful. You know, I think the thing I learned from my wife was like camo's fine, but you get one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you're wearing a camo, if you have a camo bag, you don't also wear a camo jacket or right, camo pants.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I may try and get a pair of pants in this jigsaw, but I won't wear both at the same time, I promise.
Yeah, that would be a little, yeah, over the top.
Maybe
yeah,
at the cottage.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
But yeah, the head to toe would be too much for sure. But this was fun. I had a good time. I didn't know when it would arrive, and arrived just in time for the recording. So
yeah,
check it out in the show notes if you want to see the patterning. It's got some great pockets and a big stiff collar. Lots of room for a sweater, despite being a medium. So really good, and I'm definitely a fan. And I think at this point, I love finding stuff like this because the stuff on their site's not that expensive. Some of it is, but for the most part, it's a lot of like affordable stuff.
Yeah.
And it just makes the coolest gift.
They've actually got an $11,000 Luftwaffe World War II Glashütte chronograph on their site, which is amazing.
Oh, there you go. I had not come across any watches.
But the one I'm looking at, speaking of sweaters, they have a British RAF woolly pulley. So a commando sweater. And it looks amazing. Oh, I wish I hadn't seen this. My collection of commando sweaters is already too big, but this blue color is lovely.
So you found the blue one. If you're looking at it right now, because I don't have it on my screen, I was going to buy one of those for you and have it delivered with this jacket, but they only had small and X small, I think, and the sizing on the site would have been too small for you.
Oh,
or
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
And I think right now you and I would be almost the same size,
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
Me maybe slightly bigger. But yeah, so sit tight on that one. I'll see if I can snag you one when they restock, or if it showed, maybe it shows that they've got large and maybe a medium would work, but
I'm seeing a large and blue here. This is pretty gorgeous. Oh man. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah. They're fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, good one. Very, very good.
Shout out to Americana Pipe Dream for sure. And also to Peter at your first podcast. So that's final notes.
Yeah.
That was a fun episode and always nice to have another chat on, especially one that we like didn't have to plan for or ship a microphone or any of that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, really good stuff.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the episode. And as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from William Butler Yeats, who said, "There are no strangers here, only friends you haven't yet met."